I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, February the 24th. And on today's show, we are talking with Queenie Chu, the CEO of Success Organization, about the recent spike last year of hate crimes, which went up 717% against Asian populations in Vancouver, according to new data from the Vancouver Police Department. We'll talk with Queenie about what she thinks would help solve this problem and make people feel safe reporting hate crimes to police. First, though, our news headlines from Jim Mangi.
Vancouver City Council is considering the creation of a small curbside parklet on a quiet side street in the downtown east side where public alcohol consumption would be legalized. The idea is an outdoor expansion of the Community Managed Alcohol Program, or CMAP, which Portland Hotel Society Community Services has operated for more than a decade. The site would be in front of CMAP's home at 111 Princess Avenue at Alexander Street and would be similar to the temporary patios that have appeared outside restaurants around town in the last year. Research has consistently shown alcohol has the highest economic cost to society of any substance, both in BC and across Canada. The Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction estimated in 2018 that alcohol costs the country's economy more than four times than that of all opioids combined. Peter Wall, the founder of the Wall Financial Group and one of Vancouver's most prominent political donors, has donated $1 million to the Vancouver Police Department's Charity Foundation, in part to increase community policing in and around the downtown east side, an area he says the city has failed with its misguided approach to drug use and homelessness. Kevin Walby, a criminology professor at the University of Winnipeg, said Mr. Wall's largesse is part of a concerning trend in Canada that has long caught on in the United States. Professor Walby said Mr. Wall's donation is more problematic because he is directly requesting more policing of the downtown east side. Vancouver City Councillor Jean Swanson agrees with Mr. Wall that the city has not done enough to provide proper housing for those living in the downtown east side, but she vehemently opposes his prescription for more policing in the area. In a statement, Jean Swanson said, "I don't think it's right that private rich people should be making decisions that get police to do what they want." In an effort to decamp the tent city in Vancouver's Strathcona Park, the province has announced the opening of two temporary shelters in April. In a media release, Attorney General David Eby said, "These new shelter spaces will provide 120 people with a bed and supports to help them stay safe, warm, fed, and alive, while we continue to work with our partners to open permanent supportive housing across the city." The former home of Vancouver's Army and Navy Department Store is now co-leased by BC Housing and the city and will be renovated to create a 60-bed shelter on West Hastings Street between Abbott and Carroll Streets. An industrial property at 875 Terminal Avenue, which is owned by the City of Vancouver, will provide the additional 60 beds. Residents at both locations will have 24-hour access to support services. And those are the headlines for today.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO 100.5 FM and online at thepulse.cooperadio.org. I'm David Ball with Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Well, last week, the Vancouver Police Department revealed that 2020 saw a 717% spike in hate crimes reported against Asian Canadians in Vancouver. They're urging people to come forward, but there are some barriers to people doing so. Here's a clip from Premier John Horgan speaking about hate crimes on Thursday.
An 80-plus-year-old Asian man assaulted by a youth for no reason other than the color of his skin. That's absolutely unacceptable, and it's not just in the United States. We will be bringing forward anti-racism legislation this year. Roshna Singh has been appointed the parliamentary secretary to work with the Attorney General on those issues. In addition to that, Mike Farnworth, the Solicitor General, has been reaching out to law enforcement across British Columbia to reinforce the importance of prosecuting hate crimes.
And that was John Horgan, the Premier. Queenie Chu is the CEO of Success, which operates a number of seniors' homes, employment programs, and other trainings in Chinatown and around the Lower Mainland. Queenie, it's an honor to have you here on The Pulse on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to ask you, how have you been? It's been a long year since we last talked.
Yeah, and things have changed. And with COVID, it seems to be changing many of our lives, work, and how we conduct our business now.
I wanted to ask you about this latest data from the Vancouver Police Department. Hate crimes against Asian Canadians went up 717%. That's more than 7 times increase. So almost 100 hate crimes reported and only 12 in previous years. I mean, what's your reaction to that terrible statistic?
It's appalling. It's disturbing. It's upsetting. With COVID, it's also exacerbated the situation. Many of the East Asian demographics were blamed for the situation of COVID and pandemic, which is uncalled for. And racism happened even before COVID, due to COVID, it also exacerbated the situation.
Some of the most disturbing incidents, Queenie, were ones against seniors. I remember seeing several videos of people being pushed, and it was just heartbreaking. That must have been very disturbing when you work with seniors and see how vulnerable they can be.
Absolutely, David. I think, those situations should not be happening. And absolutely, I think that it's very important the system, to have a legislation, for example, on anti-racism. And I think that Premier Hogan also spoke up to that yesterday at the news conference. And I'm all for it. We need to have a very clear definition of what hate crime is. Because hate crime can be in any shape and forms. Is online hate crime? Is it a crime? Is spitting at people? Is it a crime? We totally understand when it gets into the physical trauma. That's been made clear as a crime. But what about emotional trauma that impact the people, the victims, and the bystanders of those racial situations? Is that a crime? How people are being prosecuted. So when we ask people to report, when we see those hate crime or racial situation happening, when we ask people to report all those incidents to the law enforcement establishment, and yet we don't hear that they get prosecuted. So it's kind of a letdown to those people, or in a way also discourage people in doing that. So I think it's important to look at what are the consequences of people's behavior if that's the case. And so that's one. I think it's also very important to also acknowledge and examine the systemic racism across all institutions, including within the government departments, educational system, and healthcare. As you have seen from the media, that it happened not just attacking East Asian people, it's with all racial minority people. Whether it's First Nation, situation with the healthcare system. So I think that really tells the story about the systemic racism across all institutions, and we need to acknowledge and examine what's been happening there.
Now, we've seen the public safety minister, Mike Farnworth, call on police to be willing to prosecute hate-motivated crimes more. What would you like to see from the Vancouver Police Department? I know they have a hate crimes unit. I know they're calling for people to come forward and say they'll take it seriously. Is there more they could do, especially in regards to anti-Asian racism?
So I understand that they certainly are doing their job, but it's up to the judicial system to look at what was the charges to lay on those offenders. So I think that the overall judicial system needs to be looked at in addressing hate crime and racial associated situation as a whole, so that, you know, really is that people need to know that we see this as very serious crime happening in the community, which affect the overall, you know, unity within our community, affecting also our values that fundamentally as Canadians that we believe in, the diversity and also the inclusion. So, so having said that, I think that there is also other ways to look at, you know, how to address this very serious problem.
Let's say a bit more, but what are some of those ways?
I really would like to see a collection of the race-based data in consultation with communities and be open about why and what data is collected and how it will be used to make improvements. So I know it's been a controversial topic about collecting race-based data, but if we don't know what we don't know, how are we going to make sure the corrective actions being implemented? So it is important we understand what actually the situation is like, who are being targeted, how that is being targeted, and what should we do about those situations. So those are very important, but make sure we explain to people why and what this data is collected and how that is being used to make improvements. Mm-hmm. The other piece is I really would like to call for actions to have adequate funding for anti-racism initiatives. Not piecemeal funding, but sustainable funding to create long-term impacts. Those are very important. And also continues to build a supportive and safe communities to ensure those community members to speak out and intervene against racism when they witness it in their communities. Support those being affected, like providing crisis counseling helplines for those experiencing racism and those that undergone a lot of long-term trauma from it. So this is important. Lastly, I also wanted to make sure those people who are not directly targeted, you know, or impacted, I would like to see that to look at funding the education about historical and contemporary racism in Canada and in all its forms, so that other people who are not directed understand what these issues are.
Did you imagine, you know, leading an organization like Success with so many services 1 year ago that you would be doing all the things the way you're doing them today?
It's beyond my imagination. That's kind of like understatement, because many of our services have to be pivot to virtual or by phone during COVID, and also under the public health orders, like the provincial public health orders. So certainly, you know, we have changed the way we conduct our business and how, you know, clients be able to access our services as well.
Now, I know that a lot of your clients are older community members. Is that difficult in terms of the technology? Do you find that there's a barrier?
Well, absolutely. You know, there are certain demographics of our clientele. They are less digital inclined, and some of them do not have access to any communicable devices like a cell phone even, or a computer, or even internet access for that matter. So that makes it very tough and challenging for those populations.
How do you get around this at Success? How do you manage to include people who really need your services, who are maybe more vulnerable or less technologically connected?
So we have a number of ways to do that. We're still kind of trying to provide one-on-one in-person services as long as they are COVID compliant. What I mean is that they do not have COVID symptoms, or if they are sick, they cannot come to our services. They wear a mask, and we provide a mask as well. And they wash their hands before coming for the appointment. And we do the screening as well, the COVID symptom screening as well. So we follow the protocols and as well as the WorkSafe BC protocols for the one-on-one meeting. For those people who not digitally inclined, we also offer the classes such as the seniors go digital. You know, we actually were able to access some funding and to support those people who have a challenge in whether accessing the equipment, having the skill set to access, you know, those platforms like Zoom and GoToMeeting and Teams, etc., on a virtual basis. So every step of the way, we try to address the issues. Unfortunately, sometimes the funding is not there, so it makes it very challenging to provide the equipment as well as internet access, and plus the, you know, the training of how to access those, you know, the digital means.
How does that affect the people you serve? This must be a very isolating experience for so many.
There are some seniors that have been isolated, and so we, as you know, we also serve Meals on Wheels with another partner who deliver the meals to the individual who subscribes to the programs. So what we do is we do also a friendly chat and making sure they're okay, not just delivering the meals, but also a friendly chat and reaching out to them and make sure they are okay. And we also have programs like drop off, helping them to get groceries and drop off groceries at their doorsteps, as well as we also do the friendly phone call to reach out to individuals who otherwise will be isolated or live alone.
How are seniors coping with the isolation? I know in long-term homes, it's really, really tragic, but even in people's regular houses, if they're not having their social connections, it's a big loss.
Absolutely. And I actually did send out, a short video, send it to them. Again, you know, they would have to access to the platform in order to listen in. And I wanted to really engage them and connect them the best I can or we can during COVID. As you know, we have to stay home, right? So all the gatherings, events, the workshops, they cannot be happening. And so we provide virtually, but in order to do that, people need to have the basic equipment and skill set to access the program. So that's been a challenge, I have to say. But we do have, for example, people living at home, and if they're isolated, we also do a friendly call for those individuals who, before COVID, attending our adult day programs. So instead of attending in person, so we actually have staff to reach out to call them individually to make sure they're okay, you know, at home. If they have any questions or needs, you know, we encourage them to reach out to us.
One of the things I know so many people look forward to every year is the Chinese New Year celebration. Would have been last week. And obviously, because of COVID, it couldn't happen. Are there other ways that people celebrated?
Well, there are a number of ways that people celebrate that Lunar New Year. I know we used to have the Chinatown you know, the Lunar New Year parade, which attracts thousands and thousands of people.
And you see the looks on their faces, especially the seniors who would get so dressed up and be so happy to see all the you know, everything that's walking and the dragons and all the people.
Yeah, the light, I mean, the sound and, you know, people and, you know, just give them the sense of, joy and during the festive season that they can identify with. So with COVID, we can't do it now. So we certainly have pivoted ourselves to reinforce, okay, you can do the celebration within your household. You can do a takeout, you know, if you don't want to cook. You can call for a takeout and because, you know, we can't have big gatherings at the restaurant if they're not under the same household, and we can have not more than six people at a table. So we wanted to reinforce that. We wanted to make sure people are safe as well. We follow the BCCDC guidelines for the safe celebration of Lunar New Year. So we want to make sure people understand, you know, this is temporary. We hope that this doesn't happen again, you know, after the vaccine. So there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we just have to be a bit patient at this point in time so that we are safe and curb the spread of the virus.
Mm. You mentioned the vaccine, Queenie. Can you tell me what the progress is on getting first doses to your residents in some of your buildings and to your membership?
Well, for those people who live in our long-term care facility, they all have the second dose already.
The second dose. Amazing. How many people is that?
114.
Wow.
And they all have the second dose, and also the frontline healthcare workers, they all offer the vaccine as well for the second dose. We already vaccinated before. The first was in January, and then the I think it was in December, January, and then the second dose just happened yesterday.
How did that make you feel? To know that people are that protected, they say 94.5% protected.
Well, you know, definitely, you know, David, we heard so much tragic stories that happened in long-term care, including my mother, who died before, I mean, just before Christmas.
I'm so sorry, Queenie. My condolences.
Thank you. So I wanted to make sure, you know, people... especially those seniors living in long-term care, they should not be die alone, and they should not be die of COVID, and they shouldn't be left alone and die there as well. So it was very emotional for me for that, and I wanted to make sure, you know, at least those people we care for in our care home, this doesn't occur in our care home, and people need to be supported, needs to be connected with the families at every step of the way. Even if it is not in person, they should have the abilities to connect with the families as well. Because we are all human beings. We need that connection. We need that social connection and emotional support, especially during the COVID pandemic.
I think that's been the most tragic thing of all, was seeing how isolated so many people in long-term care homes have been in Canada. And it breaks my heart because it seems like we don't care for our seniors.
So, again, that's very tragic. And so we try our best so that it doesn't occur to anyone. You know, we hope certainly during the COVID, while we have the provincial public health orders, we still wanted to make sure to develop a way to connect people, you know, especially during the festive time of Lunar New Year, which the majority of the Asian seniors really identify with it and really enjoy those festivities. So So we try to kind of encourage people to connect, but in a different way, so that they are, while they are safe.
How much, I know that your background was in nursing. Originally, you worked in Alberta as a nurse. And am I right that you went on to become executive director of the Alberta Health Services for the whole province?
Yeah.
Tell me how your background in nursing kind of helped inform how you worked with seniors throughout this last year.
Actually, my past experience, has been in long-term care. And I went for my master's degree in nursing and specialized in gerontology at the University of Alberta. So my passion is really to support and empower seniors who are able to live at home as long as possible. But if they do need, assisted living or long-term care, they would have that opportunity as well. So, as our baby boomers, as you know, our first baby boomer actually reached 75 years old now. There is going to be a critical a mass of gray tsunamis coming in already, needing some sort of care in the community. And this is very important for us to really plan proactively and be able to understand what are the needs of those baby boomers and be able to support them. And really looking at, how we're going to ensure the quality of life is there in order to support them wherever they are.
It sounds like you're keeping your eye on some of the big long-term challenges beyond COVID. It sounds like you're kind of seeing what's coming even after we've hopefully defeated this coronavirus.
Absolutely. We needed to really come together, and look at how we going to look at our system. And David, as you know, and it has been published actually, that the confidence of people in long-term care actually is declining because what's been happening in long-term care as a result of COVID. So a lot of people, they might not want their loved ones to go to long-term care directly and instantly. So they might have a second thought on that. So I think that if that is true, and I think that that probably is true, I think it's important to look at what are other ways to support people at home and how can we support the informal caregivers who've been caring for the loved ones at home and so that they don't get burnout. And they also continue to be able to support their loved ones at home. Well, the thing is that, there's nowhere like home, okay? We can not replace what a home-like environment is like. And so I think that the question is, how can we support people living at home while maintaining the dignity, respect, and decision-making ability of the individual? So I think this is a fundamental question to really, I would like to call for action, and to government, to the provincial or federal government, to look at how we fundamentally look at our healthcare system and how we're going to care for the seniors.
Thank you so much, Queenie. Take good care.
Yeah, all right. It's nice to talk with you.
Happy New Year.
And you too, bye now.
And that was Queenie Chu, the CEO of Success.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org. CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.